You wouldn't sign it with your own name, the Apocalypse of Joe, but the name of a famous religious figure, the Apocalypse of Daniel. If you wanted to narrate a gospel of Jesus' most important teachings, but in fact were living 100 years after Jesus and didn't have any real access to what Jesus said, you would write down the sayings you found most compelling and claim to be someone who had actually heard Jesus speak, calling your book the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Philip. This motivation was at work in both Christian and non-Christian circles. We know this because ancient authors actually tell us so. For example, a commentator on the writings of Aristotle, a pagan scholar named David, indicated, "If someone is uninfluential and unknown, yet wants his writing to be read, he writes in the name of someone who came before him and was influential, so that, through his influence, he can get his work accepted." This is the case with the one instance we have of a Christian forger who was caught and who later explained in writing what he did. In the 5th Christian century, a church leader named Salvian lived in Marseille. As did many others in his day, Salvian decided, with his wife, to express his devotion to God by renouncing the world and taking on an ascetic form of life. Salvian was outraged by the worldliness of the church and by church members who were more concerned with personal comfort and wealth than with the demands of the gospel. So, he wrote a letter called Timothy to the Church. Written in an authoritative style, the letter seemed to its readers actually to have been written by Timothy, the famous companion of the Apostle Paul 400 years earlier. But somehow, Salvian's bishop came to suspect that Salvian had written it. He confronted Salvian with the matter, and Salvian admitted that he had done it. But Salvian was a defensive fellow, and so he wrote an explanation for why he had produced a pseudonymous letter. As defensive individuals often do, Salvian made lots of excuses. The name Timothy, for example, literally means honored by God. And so, he said, he used that name to show that he wrote for the honor of God. His main defense, though, was that he was a nobody, and if he himself wrote a letter to the churches, no one would pay attention. Or, as he put it in his written defense, the author had wisely selected a pseudonym for his book for the obvious reason that he did not wish the obscurity of his own person to detract from the influence of his otherwise valuable book. By writing in the name of Timothy, on the other hand, he hoped to get a reading. His views were important enough for him to adopt a false name. There's nothing in the story to suggest that Salvian's bishop accepted this excuse with equanimity. The story is related to us by Salvian, not his bishop. On the contrary, if the bishop was like every other reader from the ancient world who comments on such things, he was not at all pleased that Salvian had lied about his identity. Forger's techniques. We are never told how Salvian's bishop came to realize that the letter allegedly by Timothy was in fact written by his presbyter, Salvian. But it is probably not too hard to figure out. The letter addressed major concerns that Salvian himself had had, and that he no doubt had articulated repeatedly among his fellow churchgoers and the church leaders. Since he was a literate person, he may well have written other treatises on this and related subjects. If his bishop knew Salvian's ultimate concerns and had read his other writings, so that he was familiar with his writing style, he may have put two and two together and realized that this letter, which suddenly appeared out of nowhere, was a modern production, written pseudonymously. Very few forgers in the ancient world were actually caught red-handed. The reasons should seem fairly obvious. For one thing, ancient scholars who were invested in detecting forgeries did not have the sophisticated methods of analysis that we have today, with our computers, databases, intricate analyses of writing style, and so on. An ancient scholar frequently could tell that a literary text was not by the same author who wrote another text. For example, that the book of Revelation was not written by the same author who wrote the 4th Gospel. But it's much easier to say who did not write a book, Paul did not write Hebrews, than who did write it. Ephesians, if not by Paul, was written by whom? Even more important, forgers went out of their way not to get caught. Most of the time they were successful. In one of the fascinating modern discussions of forgery, Anthony Grafton, of Princeton University, shows that over the centuries the art of forgery became increasingly refined as the art of detecting forgery improved its methods. The better scholars became at recognizing a forgery, the better forgers got at avoiding detection. This compelled the scholars to refine their methods, which in turn drove the forgers to improve their craft. Ancient forgers typically used several methods to escape detection. First, and most obviously, anyone forging a document in the name of a well-known author did his level best to imitate the author's writing style and vocabulary. Everyone has a distinctive style of writing, and every style, in principle, can be imitated. Less skillful imitators simply recognized unusual words commonly used by an author and used those words a lot, sometimes much more than the author being imitated. Others tried to imitate the distinctive ways the author used grammar, sentence length, use of participial phrases, use of sentence fragments, and so on. For highly educated authors, this matter of imitating writing style was almost second nature. In the advanced education of rhetorical schooling that the upper-class elite received, a regular exercise involved writing an account or a speech in the style of a famous author or speaker. The most highly educated people in the empire were trained to do this as a matter of course. Most of those people, of course, were not involved in the business of forgery. The fact that a forger tried to imitate an author's style can make it difficult to detect forgeries, but the reality is that some people were more skilled at it than others. Just as most people today couldn't forge a Rembrandt if their life depended on it, so too, most people can't sound just like Aristotle, Plutarch, or Paul. A second trick of forgers was to include verisimilitudes in their writings. The term verisimilitude refers to a statement, a comment, or an off-the-cuff remark that makes a writing look very similar to what you would expect the alleged author to have said. Forgers would make personal comments about the recipients of a letter, even if in fact they were not actually sending it to anyone. Why say you'll be praying for the letter's recipients during their time of persecution if you're not actually sending it to people experiencing persecution? Because if you say that, it certainly sounds as though you're sending it to those experiencing persecution. Why ask for a personal favor from a person you're writing to if you're not really writing to that person? Hey, James, be sure to say hello to your mother for me, and don't forget to bring that book that I left at your house. Because there's no better way to make it look as if the letter is authentic. Why fabricate names of recipients, your past relationship with these recipients, remembered experiences you've shared, and so on? All of these add credibility to your writing, making it look as though you really are writing this person, at this time, in this situation, even if you're writing 300 years later to no one in particular. We've already seen one kind of verisimilitude in our earlier discussion. In both 2 Thessalonians from the 1st century and the Apostolic Constitutions 300 years later, the pseudonymous author tells his readers not to read pseudonymous writings. Or to be more precise, the forger warns his readers not to read forgeries. Why? In part because it makes readers less likely to suspect that the book they have is itself a forgery. That is, it's a kind of verisimilitude. One final technique used by some forgers involves a discovery narrative. If a book shows up this week claiming to have been written 200 years ago, one might well wonder where it has been all this time. Forgers sometimes begin or end their writing by describing what has led to the book's disappearance and discovery. For example, an author might begin a book by explaining that he had a dream, and in this dream he was told to dig a deep hole on the south side of the oak tree in the field across the stream from his farm. When he dug the hole, he found an ancient wooden box. Inside the box was a deteriorating manuscript. He has now copied this manuscript out by hand, and this is it, a revelation given directly by Christ to the Apostle James and hidden from the world until now. The book then claims to have been written by James as copied by the discoverer of the manuscript. The book is not widely known because it has been hidden all these years, but now it has come to light, and here it is. Except it's not really here. What is here is a book not written by James, but by a forger claiming to be James, who has conveniently included an explanation for why no one has ever heard of this book before. Ancient views of forgery. I have already indicated that scholars are sometimes loath to use the term forgery for pseudepigraphal writings in which an author claims to be someone else. Later, I deal at greater length with what some scholars have claimed about this phenomenon in order to avoid thinking of such books as forgeries. This will come in Chapter 4, after we have had two chapters of data to help us assess these claims. As it turns out, many New Testament scholars who make pronouncements on forgery, "It wasn't meant to be deceitful, no one thought of it as lying, it wasn't looked down upon," simply haven't read what the ancient sources say about it. Throughout this book, it will become quite clear from the ancient writings themselves that, even though forgery was widely practiced, it was also widely condemned and treated as a form of lying. To get us started here, I want to give just a few examples, which could easily be multiplied, of how ancients thought and talked about the practice of forgery. The first thing to note is that in virtually every instance in which an ancient author mentions forgery, he condemns it. There are a few exceptions, which I will discuss at greater length in Chapter 4, but these exceptions really are exceptional, for reasons we'll see. By far the dominant discourse in the ancient world opposed forgery and saw it as a deceitful and illicit practice. That doesn't mean that people didn't engage in the practice. Adultery is usually seen as a deceitful and illicit practice today, but that doesn't stop a lot of people. Despite the condemnations of it, the practice of forgery thrived in antiquity. One of the more famous stories of forgery involves the 2nd century Roman physician Galen, whom I mentioned earlier. In one of his surviving writings, Galen gives an autobiographical account in which he tells of detecting a forgery. As he relates it, he was one day walking down a street in Rome and was passing by a bookseller's shop. In the window were two men arguing about a book that was allegedly written by Galen. One man was heatedly arguing that Galen had in fact written the book. The other was insisting that the writing style was all wrong, that Galen could not have written it. This episode warmed the cockles of Galen's heart, since in fact he had not written the book. So he went home and wrote a book, which we still have today. Sometimes the book is called How to Recognize Books Written by Galen. Did Galen think it was an acceptable practice for someone else to write in his name? Obviously not. Nor did anyone else who discovered forgeries in his own name. I earlier mentioned the poet Martial, who was incensed that other poets tried to pass off their own work, which he considered vastly inferior, as his. Among Christians, we have outraged complaints about forgeries in the writings of Origen, Jerome, and Augustine. Forgery was so widely condemned in antiquity that even forgers condemned forgery, as we have seen in the case of 2 Thessalonians and the Apostolic Constitutions. Some scholars have argued, strenuously but without much evidence, that it was a common and accepted practice in schools of philosophy to write a philosophical treatise and sign your master's name to it, Plato, Pythagoras, etc., rather than your own, and that no one looked askance at this practice. As we will see in Chapter 4, there is little evidence indeed that this happened. Ask a modern-day scholar who claims that in antiquity this was a widespread practice to cite an ancient source for it. In almost every instance, you will find a tongue-tied scholar. That forgery was widely condemned in antiquity can be seen by some of the terms that were used to describe the practice, most of which were at least as negative as the modern term forgery. In Greek, the two most common words to describe literary texts whose authors falsely claim to be a well-known figure are pseudos, which means a falsehood or a lie, and natos, which means an illegitimate child, with connotations similar to our modern word bastard. With respect to the first word, some scholars have stressed that pseudos does not have to have the negative connotation of a bald-faced lie, since it is sometimes used simply to indicate information that is incorrect, a falsehood. And that is certainly true in some contexts. But it means that only in contexts in which those speaking the falsehood do not realize that what they are saying is an error. When a person speaks something that is false, knowing that it is false, pseudos always means what lie means in English, an intentional falsehood with the intent of deceiving hearers or readers into thinking that it is right. There can be no question which connotation applies to ancient forgeries. The person who wrote the Gospel of Peter claiming to be Jesus' disciple Simon Peter, some 60 years after Peter's death, did he realize that he was not, in fact, Simon Peter? Unless he was a lunatic, then of course he did. He intentionally claimed to be someone he was not. In Greek, that would be called a pseudas. In English, we would call it a lie. The other term, notos, might seem a bit puzzling. It is often translated spurious, which may be accurate enough, but does not carry the same connotations as the Greek word, which refers typically to a bastard child. The logic of the term in the context of forgeries is clear. If a child born out of wedlock is raised by his mother and her husband, who is not the child's father, then the child does not belong by blood to his alleged father. They are not related. Moreover, in antiquity, the child had no legal rights. So too with a literary text. If it goes under the name of an author who did not in fact produce it, then it is not actually related or legally connected to that person, but derives from someone else. So it is called a notos, an illegitimate child, a text that does not belong to the author claimed for it. Both of these terms are negative, not neutral, and they show what ancients thought about the practice of forgery. An author who produces a writing in the name of someone else has produced a false writing, a lie, an illegitimate child, or a bastard. Similar words are used by Latin writers for the act of forgery. For example, words that mean to lie, to falsify, to fabricate, to adulterate, to counterfeit. Contrary to what some scholars have claimed, again see chapter 4, forgers in the ancient world typically wanted to deceive their readers by claiming to be persons of authority and standing. This has been long recognized by the real experts in ancient forgery. And a moment's reflection shows why this must be the case. Consider the motivations for forgery mentioned earlier. Forgers who wanted to see if they could get away with it, to see if they could pull the wool over someone's eyes, would scarcely have tried to make their ploy transparent and obvious. They would have truly wanted to deceive people. If they wanted to make money by producing an original copy of, say, a dialogue of Plato, they wouldn't get very far if everyone knew who they really were. If they wanted to justify a political institution or a religious practice by citing the views of an authority, or wanted to have their own views accepted as authoritative, even if they themselves were completely unknown, it would make no sense to claim to be someone else, knowing full well that no one would believe you. That forgery was not a transparent fiction is evidenced as well by the negative things people say about it in the ancient sources. The practice, as I have argued, is condemned in virtually every instance it is discussed. Moreover, the reactions to forgers when they are caught show quite clearly that they meant to deceive, that they were often successful, and that people were not at all pleased when they discovered the truth. Galen and Marshall were incensed to find someone else claiming their name for writings they did not produce, and sometimes the reaction was even more hostile. The first time we hear of a forger being discovered occurs all the way back in the 5th century BCE, in the writings of the famous Greek historian Herodotus. In a puzzling and enigmatic passage, Herodotus speaks of Onomacritus of Athens, who had invented an oracle, that is, a prophecy from a divine being, and ascribed to it the ancient bard Musaeus, a mythical figure thought to be able to predict the future. This oracle indicated that a certain group of islands would sink into the sea. It is hard to understand why Onomacritus forged the oracle, or why people were upset by it, but they were. The ruler of Athens, Hipparchus, banished Onomacritus from the city. He fled Greece and ended up in Persia. On yet other occasions, Onomacritus was thought to have forged other oracles and was roundly chastised for it by other ancient authors, such as Plutarch. Sometimes the punishment for forgery was even more harsh. Earlier I mentioned the 50 obscene letters that the philosopher Diodamus forged in the name of Epicurus in order to sully his reputation. According to one ancient source, Epicurus's followers were not amused. One of them, a man named Zeno, tracked Diodamus down and murdered him for it. This can be compared with the account already mentioned by the Jewish historian Josephus, who indicates that someone forged a letter in the name of Alexander, son of King Herod, indicating Alexander's plan to assassinate his father. As we have seen, the forger was the king's own secretary, who, according to Josephus, was at last put to death for it. From all the discussions of forgeries in ancient sources, I think we can safely draw several major conclusions. Forgery was widely practiced in the ancient world, among pagans, Jews, and Christians. Forgers, motivated by a range of factors, intended to deceive their readers. Ancient authors who discussed the practice condemned it and considered it a form of lying and deceit. Forgers who were caught were reprimanded or punished even more severely. Possible justifications for forgery. The most thorough study of ancient forgery ever undertaken by the Austrian classical scholar Wolfgang Speier maintains, "Every forgery feigns a state of affairs that does not correspond to the actual facts of the case. For this reason, forgery belongs to the realm of lying and deception." This view coincides perfectly well with the one I have been trying to make in this chapter, but it leaves us with a problem. When we are considering Christian forgeries in particular, we are dealing with writings produced by followers of Jesus, who presumably ascribed to Jesus' ethical teachings and moral norms set forth in the Hebrew Scriptures. Surely they knew that lying and deception were wrong. Why would they do what they knew was wrong? And surely the question applies to pagans and Jews as well, who, as a whole, were just as ethical as Christians. Why would any of them go against their own ethical views? On one level, of course, the question is silly. All people do things they know are wrong, but I mean the question at a deeper level. Did the forgers who perpetrated their fraud think that they were justified in lying? Is lying ever justified? I return to this issue in Chapter 8, but for now I should at least set the stage by asking a more general question. What did people in antiquity think about lying and deceit? Asking what ancient people thought about lying is like asking modern people. It depends completely on whom you ask. Some think lying is never acceptable under any circumstances. Others think that in some circumstances it is the ethical thing to do. Yet others think nothing at all about lying whenever they feel like it, thank you very much. Some ancient Greek philosophers, notably Aristotle, stressed the importance of normally being truthful. But most philosophers thought there could be exceptions. Xenophon, for example, reports Socrates as saying it is a good thing to lie to a sick son or a friend who wants to commit suicide if you can stop the person from doing so. Socrates also said that it is useful for a field general to lie to his disheartened troops in battle, telling them that support troops are soon to arrive in order to drive them to fight with greater valor, or for a parent to deceive a child into taking some unpleasant medicine that will be good for her. Plato taught that some lies can be useful, such as those doctors might tell patients for their own good, or those rulers of a country might tell their people in order to ensure the healthy functioning of society. As one ancient writer, Heliodorus, put it, "A lie is good when it benefits the one who speaks it without doing harm to the one who hears." But what about Christians? Weren't they taught always to tell the truth? That is certainly what the great 5th century church theologian Augustine taught in his two treatises devoted to lying. It is never, ever, under any circumstances permissible to lie. This view of Augustine's was not based on a simplistic sense that it is always good to tell the truth, but on deep theological understandings about what it means to be truly human in relationship to the God of truth, who himself became fully human. But lots of other Christian thinkers, both before and after Augustine, thought otherwise. Some, such as the important Christian thinker Clement of Alexandria at the end of the 2nd century, as well as his Alexandrian compatriot at the beginning of the 3rd, Origen, arguably the most important theologian of the church before Augustine, agreed with Plato about the medicinal lie. If a doctor's lie will impel a patient to take her medicine, it is ethically justified. Both of them also pointed out that in the Old Testament, God himself appears to use deception at times. When God told Jonah to proclaim to the city of Nineveh that in 40 days it would be overthrown, he obviously knew full well that the people would repent and that he would stay his hand of judgment. God never did plan then to overthrow the city, even though that's what he told his prophet to proclaim. Sometimes a deceptive statement can do a world of good. There are plenty of other examples in Scripture in which the lies of God's chosen ones lead to good ends. If Abraham had not lied about his wife Sarah, "She's my sister," he would have been killed, and the nation of Israel would never have come into existence. Genesis chapter 12. Or if Rahab the prostitute had not lied about where the Israelite spies were hiding, they may have been killed, and the children of Israel may never have been able to conquer the promised land. Joshua chapter 2. Examples could be multiplied. Sometimes lying is the right thing to do. Is that what forgers thought? That lying about who they were was worth it? That the good effects of their deception outweighed the bad? That the ends justified the means? I'm afraid we may never know what drove these people to do what they did. We simply can't peer into their hearts and minds to see what they were thinking, deep down, when they decided to hide their own identity and to claim, deceitfully, that they were someone else. Their readers, had they known, would probably have called them liars and condemned what they did. But in their own eyes, their conscience may have been free from blame, and their motives may have been as pure as the driven snow. They had a truth to convey, and they were happy to lie in order to proclaim it. Chapter 2. Forgeries in the Name of Peter. Up to this point in my discussion of ancient lying, deception, and forgery, I've been using the term truth in a very simple sense, to mean something like correct information. In reality, though, truth and its opposite, falsehood, are complex. I think we all recognize this deep down, even if we haven't given it a good deal of thought. When we watch a movie, we often ask, "Is this a true story?" By that we mean, "Is this something that really happened?" If the answer is yes, then we somehow feel assured and comforted that the events took place. And so, as a story, it is truer than one that was just made up. But even then, we never think that absolutely everything found in the movie, all of the characters, the dialogue, the individual scenes, and so on, is absolutely and completely the way it really happened. We allow for a kind of poetic license of distortion, even when acknowledging that the story is, somehow, true. One could easily make the case that a movie can be true in a deeper sense, even if it is about something that never happened. This has been my view for many years, and it used to drive my kids crazy when they were young. We'd be watching a movie and they'd say, "Dad, is this a true story?" And I'd almost always say, "Yes." But then they'd remember that I tend to have a different view of things, and they'd ask the follow-up question. "No, Dad, I mean, did this really happen?" And I'd say no, and they'd continue to be puzzled, as some of my readers may be. How can a story be true if it didn't happen? In point of fact, there are all sorts of true stories that didn't happen, as everyone will admit, I think, if they think about it a bit. When I try to illustrate this with my students, I usually rehearse for them the story of George Washington and the cherry tree. True stories that didn't happen. Every grade school kid in the country knows the cherry tree story. As a young boy, George Washington, for unknown reasons, took a hatchet to his father's cherry tree. When his father came home, he saw the tree and asked, "Who chopped down my cherry tree?" Young George answered, "I cannot tell a lie. I did it." The way the story is normally told, we don't find out what happened afterwards. Was young George taken out to the woodshed? The story ends with George's one-liner. We know that the story never happened, because the person who invented the tale later admitted to having done so. He was a Christian minister named Mason Locke Weems, usually known as Parson Weems. As a later biographer of Washington, Parson Weems confessed that he made up this story, even though he once had claimed that he received it from a credible eyewitness. A nice paradox. He told a lie in this story about not lying. Here, then, is a story that we know is non-historical, but we still tell it to our children. Why? Not because we are trying to teach them about the facts of colonial history, but because we think the story conveys a truth that we want our children to learn. The truth claims of the story actually work on several levels. On one level, the story is a good piece of political propaganda for the United States. Who was George Washington? He was the father of our nation. What kind of person was he? He was an honest man, a man who would never tell a lie. Really? How honest was he? Well, one day when he was a kid, the conclusion is clear. The country is founded on honesty. This country is honest. This country cannot tell a lie. Or so the story goes. But the story of George Washington and the cherry tree functions on another level as well, and this is probably why most parents are glad their kids learn it. This is a story about personal morality and responsibility. I told the story to my kids because I wanted them to be like young George. Even if they did something wrong, I wanted them to come clean and tell the truth about it. It is better to be truthful and face the consequences than to live a life of dishonesty. It is better not to tell a lie. My point is that fiction, even historical fiction, can in some sense convey truth, even if it is something that didn't happen. Truth is more than simply correct information. That does not mean, however, that there is no such thing as falsehood. Quite the contrary, there are plenty of kinds of falsehood. Incorrect information, flat-out deception, stories that convey messages that we do not accept as true, based on our understanding of the world. If we were to read a story about the childhood of Joseph Stalin that stressed his inherently sweet disposition, his kind, gentle nature, and his deep concern for the well-being of others, I would say that the story is false. Ancient people also had a more nuanced sense of truth and falsehood. They too had stories that they accepted as true in some sense, without thinking that they actually happened. Most scholars today recognize that the majority of educated people in ancient Greece and Rome did not literally believe that the myths about the gods had actually happened historically. They were stories intending to convey some kind of true understanding of the divine realm and humans' relationship to it. And ancients had their equivalents of modern fiction. It is true, as some scholars have emphasized, that modern notions of fiction are much more sophisticated and nuanced than anything you can find in antiquity. But in addition to myths, ancient people had epic poems, legends, and novels, sometimes called romances, which correspond in many ways to the forms of fictional narrative that we have today. People didn't tell and retell, read and recite these forms of fiction simply because they thought they were literally true, but for much the same reason that we read fiction today. For entertainment, to learn something, to help them understand themselves and their world better. The notion of fiction is very interesting. If we read a book that claims to be an authorized biography of Ronald Reagan, we expect it to stick to the facts and not to convey historically incorrect information. But if we read a novel about a president of the United States in the 1980s, a book that touts itself as pure fiction, we may expect some kinds of historical verisimilitude. The president would not be shown surfing the internet or checking his wall on Facebook, but we do not expect to be given actual historical facts about an actual historical person. Ancient equivalents to modern fiction worked the same way. Readers expected the narrative to make some kind of historical sense, that is, to be plausible, but they did not expect the story to match up to the facts of historical reality. The difference between a modern biography and a modern novel, of course, is a matter of literary genre. Scholars have long and protracted debates over what the notion of genre actually means, but for our purposes, I think a fairly rough and ready description will suffice. A genre is a kind of writing that fits certain expected forms. A short story is short, for example. A novel is longer. Both have characters and plot and other shared features that make them different from a haiku. A limerick poem has clever rhymes and a surprising punchline. Free verse has neither but relies on the depth of the language to convey meaning, and so on. The characteristics of each type of genre represent a sort of implied agreement between an author and readers. It is almost a contractual agreement in which the author provides what is expected for this kind of writing, and readers are not allowed to expect anything other than what typically happens in this kind of writing. When it comes to fiction, in nearly all its forms, readers agree to suspend judgment on the historical accuracy of the details of the narrative, while expecting, nonetheless, that the account will be historically plausible. The reason fiction works is that, for the sake of being entertained, readers are willing to make this tacit agreement with an author. When it comes to biography or historical writing, however, readers do not make this agreement. In this case, the author agrees to stick to the historical facts, insofar as she can, and readers expect her to do so. Any breach of this contract is seen as a violation of the rules and is condemned. In ancient historical writing, the matter was a bit more complicated. In large part, that was because in antiquity, there simply weren't the research tools available that we have today. Extensive access to reliable sources, copious written records, databases, data retrieval systems, the possibilities given us by mass media and electronic modes of communication. Ancient historians had to do their best to cobble together a plausible narrative of past events. It was very hard indeed to give an accurate account, though most historians tried. Nowhere was this more obviously a problem than in recording the actual words of someone who lived a long time ago. Some of the best histories from antiquity are chock full of speeches given by their main characters. But if the events took place decades or even centuries earlier, in an age before there were tape recorders or even stenographers and same-day reporting, how was a historian to know what the character actually said? There was, in fact, no way to know. For that reason, a superb historian, such as the 5th century BCE Thucydides, explicitly states that he simply made up the speeches himself. What choice did ancient historians have? The best they could do was to invent a speech that seemed appropriate to the character of the speaker and the occasion, and trust that it was a more or less close approximation of what was actually said. There was no way of showing whether the historian got it right, but educated readers realized that this is what the historians were doing. And so, here again, there was a kind of understood contract between author and readers. The author would come up with his best guess at what a speaker said, and readers would accept it for what it was, a best guess. Some scholars have thought that forgery was like that, a kind of fiction comparable to the invention of speeches in a history, in which the real author and the real readers agreed not to take seriously the false name attached to a writing. As I have shown, recent scholars who have actually studied the ancient discussions of forgery indicate that this view is not right at all. Forgeries were literary texts in which the author adopted a kind of fiction without the permission of readers. And readers, when they found out, did not appreciate it. Ancient people treated forged historical narratives, treatises, letters, and so on as false writings and lies, not as some kind of harmless and innocent fiction. That is why the ancients were so interested in seeing whether books were authentic children of their named authors, or illegitimate, nota, not really belonging to the person named as the author. So, too, ancient people recognized the difference between fabricated fictional accounts and historical narratives. Some historians, such as Lucian of Samosata and Polybius, unlike Thucydides, were quite insistent that historical narratives should indicate only what actually happened. Historians should not make up stories or even the speeches delivered by the characters in their stories. As Polybius, a 2nd century BCE Greek historian who wrote about Rome's rise to power, succinctly states it, the historian should simply record what really happened and what really was said. For Polybius, the historian is different from the tragic poet, that is, the author of fictional drama. The tragic poet should thrill and charm his audience for the moment by the verisimilitude of the words he puts into his characters' mouths. But it is the task of the historian to instruct and convince for all time serious students by the truth of the facts and the speeches he narrates. The reason a historian such as Polybius had to argue this point so strenuously, of course, is that other historians did precisely what he opposed, inventing speeches and even narratives as they saw fit for their historical accounts. It is certainly true that people in general, not just professional historians, made up a lot of stories about historical figures. In Christian circles, this can be seen for nearly every historical figure of importance we know of: Jesus, Paul, Peter, and other members of the apostolic band. In this chapter, since I'm interested in books that claim to be written by Peter, but in fact were forged in his name, let us begin by considering some of the stories invented about him, before looking at books falsely attributed to him. Stories about Peter. We have a number of books from early Christianity that tell stories about Peter. These were almost entirely made up by one Christian storyteller or another. By my definitions, these stories are not forgeries. They are not accounts that falsely claim to be written by Peter. They instead might be called fabrications, stories invented about Peter. One of the most interesting does happen to occur in a forged document. This forgery, however, is not in the name of Peter, but in the name of Titus, the companion of Paul. The New Testament contains a letter allegedly by Paul to Titus, which I argue in chapter 3 is pseudonymous, that is, a forgery. About 400 years later, another letter appeared, this one claiming to be written by Titus. It is an intriguing letter because it argues vociferously that the only way to have eternal life is by living an ascetic, chaste life. Or to put it more bluntly, one can have salvation only by refraining from sex. In the context of the forger's discussion, he cites a story about Peter that serves to illustrate his point. A peasant brings his virgin daughter to Peter to be blessed. Peter says a prayer over the girl, asking that God do what is best for her. She drops down dead. The peasant is understandably distressed, but the author of the story calls him distrustful, since he doesn't believe that what has happened is in the girl's best interest. He begs Peter to restore the girl to life, and Peter does so. But a few days later, a visitor who claims to be a Christian comes to stay with the peasant and seduces his daughter. They run off together and are never seen again. And that's the end of the story. In its context, the message is quite clear. It is far better to be dead than caught up in sexual desire. A similar narrative can be found in a collection of stories about Peter's missionary activities, probably written in the second Christian century. The account, simply called the Acts of Peter, describes the great miracles Peter performed after Jesus' resurrection and ascension, as he demonstrates the power of his risen Lord and converts innumerable persons to the faith. In one of the stories, Peter is talking to a gathering of Christians in his hometown on a Sunday. They have brought a group of sick people for him to heal. But someone in the crowd asks Peter why he won't heal his own daughter, who is lying paralyzed in the corner. Peter assures his guests that God has the power to heal the girl should he choose to do so. To prove his point, Peter orders the girl to arise and walk naturally. And she does so. But then he orders her to return to her corner paralyzed. The crowd is both amazed and distraught. Peter then tells the story of his daughter. When she was young, Peter learned in a vision from God that if she remained healthy, she would lead many astray. She apparently was beautiful as a child, and as an adult, she would entice men to sleep with her. When she was 10, a next-door neighbor attempted to seduce her, but before he could sleep with her, she became paralyzed by the mercy of God. The neighbor went blind for his troubles, until healed by Peter and converted to faith in Christ. But the girl had to remain paralyzed, lest she lead others astray. Here again, the point is perfectly clear. Sex is dangerous and to be avoided at all costs, even if it means being an invalid for life. The Acts of Peter is chiefly built around a series of contests between Peter, the representative of the true God, and a heretic named Simon, a magician empowered by the devil. Each of them can do miracles, and each tries to convince the crowd that he, not the other, stands for the truth. One of the miracles involves Peter and a smoked tuna. We are told that Peter has been trying to convince the crowds and is having little success. But he is standing by a fishmonger's shop and sees a smoked tuna hanging in the window. He asks the crowds if they will believe if he can make the dead fish come back to life. Yes, they reply, then they will believe. So he removes the tuna from the hook, throws it into a nearby pond, and orders it to come back from the dead. The fish comes back to life, not just for a few minutes, but for real. The crowd rejoices and comes to believe. Greater miracles are yet in store. Peter and Simon the magician are called by the local Roman official into the arena to compete in order to see who is the true spokesperson for God. A slave boy is ordered into the arena. Simon is instructed to kill the boy and Peter to raise him from the dead. Simon speaks a word in the boy's ear and he falls down dead. It is the heretic who speaks the word of death. But Peter tells the boy's master to take his hand and raise him up, and the boy is immediately restored to life. The man of God has the word of life. A wealthy woman then comes up to Peter and cries out for him to help her as well. Her son has died, and she desperately wants Peter to raise him back to life. Peter challenges Simon to a duel to see who can raise the man. While the crowd looks on, Simon goes through several shenanigans. Standing next to the dead body, he stoops down 3 times and stands up 3 times. And, lo and behold, the dead man raises up his head. The crowds are convinced that Simon is the true power of God, and Peter must be an imposter. They prepare to burn him at the stake, but Peter shouts them down and points out that the man has not actually been raised from the dead. He has simply moved his head. If Simon is truly from God, he will be able to raise him up and make him talk. When Simon is unable to do so, Peter then has his chance. He speaks a word, raises the man fully from the dead, and has him speak. From that hour on, the people venerated Peter as a god. The climax of the story comes when the heretic Simon announces to the crowds that he will prove his superior power by flying like a bird over the hills and temples of Rome. When the day of his feat arrives, he is true to his word and takes off, flying like a bird. Peter, not to be outdone, calls out to God and deprives Simon of his power in mid-flight. He crashes to the ground and breaks his leg. The crowds converge on him and stone him to death as an impostor. It is Peter who has the true power of God. Stories like this can be easily multiplied. In fact, they were multiplied as Christian storytellers fabricated legendary accounts of the great heroes of the faith in the second and third Christian centuries. So, they made up stories about Peter. Did they also make up writings by Peter? There seems to be no doubt about that either, nor are there many doubts about why they invented such writings. In no small measure, it is for the reason we have seen. Different Christians had competing assumptions, outlooks, practices, and theologies, all of which needed apostolic authority behind them. A writing in the name of Peter could authorize one set of views in the name of a great authority named as its author. Non-canonical writings forged in the name of Peter. The Gospel of Peter. One of the most significant Gospels to be rediscovered in modern times is the so-called Gospel of Peter. I say that it has been rediscovered because we actually knew of its existence for centuries before it turned up in an archaeological dig near the end of the 19th century. Our earlier source of information was Eusebius. Eusebius is often called the Father of Church History, since his 10-volume book, The Church History, was the first narrative account of the early Christian church. In this account, Eusebius traces the spread of the Christian movement from the time of Jesus down to his own day, the early 4th century. Eusebius is an invaluable source of information for Christianity's first 300 years. For many of his narratives, his church history is the only source we have. It is true, as scholars have increasingly recognized, that Eusebius very much puts his own slant on his accounts, that he has personal views, theological perspectives, and hidden agendas that dictate how he tells his narrative. He often needs to be taken with a pound of salt, but he is especially valuable when he quotes verbatim from the earlier sources that were available to him. In those cases, we get primary sources preserved for us from authors living before his time, direct access to earlier Christian authors whose writings have otherwise been lost. In Book 6 of his Church History, Eusebius tells the story of an important bishop of the large church in Antioch, Syria, near the end of the 2nd century, a man named Serapion. The story concerns a Gospel of Peter, and luckily this is one of those instances in which Eusebius actually quotes a primary source, a writing of Serapion himself. As bishop of one of the largest communities in Christendom, Serapion had under his jurisdiction the churches in the villages and towns of the surrounding area, including the church in the town of Rosas. Serapion indicates that while making the rounds of his churches, he visited Rosas and found there was a division in the congregation. He attributed the division to petty squabbling and learned that it may have had its roots in the gospel that was being used in the church. It was not Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, gospels that he doesn't mention, but a Gospel of Peter. Serapion's response was that Peter, of course, was a disciple of Jesus, any gospel that he wrote must be perfectly acceptable. On these grounds, he allowed the parishioners in Rosas to continue using it. But he did so without reading the book himself. When he returned to Antioch, he learned from several informers that the gospel, in fact, was a problem. It contained heretical teachings. In particular, it was used by a group of Christians known as Docetists. Docetists, from the Greek word dokeo, to seem or to appear, maintained that since Christ was fully divine, he could not have been fully human and could not have really suffered. People suffer. God doesn't suffer. Why then did Christ seem to be human? For Docetists, it was all an appearance. Christ didn't have a real flesh and blood body and didn't really suffer and die. He only seemed to do so. Docetists maintained that Christ was not a real human being in two different ways. Some Docetists claimed that Christ's body only seemed to be human because it was, in fact, phantasmal, like Casper the Friendly Ghost. The other Docetic view is a bit more complicated. It maintained that there was a real man, Jesus, flesh and blood like the rest of us, but there was also a different being known as the Christ. The Christ was a divine being who descended from heaven and came into Jesus at his baptism, the dove that descended on him and went into him, empowering him to perform miracles and deliver his divine teachings. Then, before Jesus died, the Christ left him to return to its heavenly home. So some people might have mistakenly thought that the Christ was a human who really died, but that was only Jesus. The Christ was divine and could not suffer. When Serapion received word that the gospel he had previously approved might contain Docetic teachings, he was naturally disturbed, and so he procured a copy to read. Sure enough, he came to think that even though most of the account was perfectly orthodox, a right teaching, some parts were not. Serapion decided that the book was forged, and he wrote a letter to the Christians of Rosas disallowing its use. In a kind of appendix, he gave a list of the offensive passages. Eusebius quotes from the letter in his Church History, but unfortunately he does not include the appendix with the portions that Serapion found objectionable. That is very much to be regretted, for a Gospel of Peter has been discovered in modern times, and without knowing what Serapion's book said, it is difficult to know if what we now have is the same book he had. The modern discovery occurred in 1886 or 1887, during an archaeological dig near the city of Akhmim in Upper Egypt. To the northeast of this city are three cemeteries, and during the winter months of 1886 to 1887, a French archaeological team working out of Cairo was digging in the tombs. They uncovered the tomb of a person they took to be a monk, because he was buried with a sacred book. Modern scholars are less sure that he was a monk. Almost anyone could have been buried with an important book. The book itself was highly significant. It is 66 pages in length, written in Greek on vellum, pages made out of animal skin, and it contains a small anthology of four texts. The first of these, occupying the first 10 pages, is a gospel that was previously unknown. The gospel is not a complete text with beginning, middle, and end. It starts in the middle of a story. But none of the Jews washed his hands, nor did Herod, or any of his judges. Since they did not wish to wash, Pilate stood up. What follows is an alternative account of the trial, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus. Alternative in that the story differs in remarkable ways from the accounts in the New Testament gospels. One key difference can be seen already in this opening verse. In the New Testament, it is only in the Gospel of Matthew that we have a story of Pilate washing his hands at Jesus' trial, declaring himself innocent of this man's blood. Chapter 27, verse 24. Matthew says nothing about anyone else washing or refusing to wash his hands, but that is stressed here. And who does not wash their hands? The Jews, Herod, the Jewish king, and his Jewish judges. This gospel maintains even more emphatically than the gospels of the New Testament that the blame for Jesus' death falls squarely upon the Jewish people and their leaders. This anti-Jewish emphasis is part of a trend we can see developing throughout the early Christian tradition. With the passing of time, the fact that the Romans killed Jesus retreats into the background, and the Jewish leaders and Jewish people are made increasingly culpable. That can be seen simply by looking chronologically at the Gospels of the New Testament. Our earliest Gospel, Mark, seems to suggest that the decision to have Jesus killed is shared by the Jewish leaders and the Roman governor Pilate, although even here Pilate's hand seems to be forced. When we come to the Gospel of Luke, written later, Pilate actually declares Jesus innocent 3 times, so that the fault for his death falls on the Jewish leaders who demand it. The Gospel of Matthew, written at about the same time as Luke, has Pilate wash his hands to declare that he is innocent in the shedding of Jesus' blood. Somewhat notoriously, the Jewish people, this is only in Matthew, cry out, "His blood be upon us and our children." Chapter 27, verse 25. In other words, for Matthew, the Jewish people are willing to accept the responsibility and consequences of Jesus' death and to pass the responsibility on to their descendants. This verse, of course, came to be used for horrible acts of Christian anti-Semitism down through the Middle Ages and even today. The Gospel of John, the last of our canonical Gospels, goes a step farther. Here, we are told that the Jewish people rejected Jesus as their king and declared that, "We have no king but Caesar," even though God himself was to be the king over his people. And then John says that Pilate handed Jesus over to them to be crucified. Chapter 19, verse 16. In this distortion of historical reality, it is the Jews themselves who actually kill Jesus. And so, as time goes on, within the Christian tradition, Pilate becomes increasingly innocent in the death of Jesus, and the Jewish people and their leaders become increasingly guilty. The Gospel of Peter is even later than John, and here, Jewish responsibility is heightened further. Now, it is not even the Roman governor Pilate who orders Jesus crucified, it is the Jewish King Herod. "Then King Herod ordered the Lord to be taken away and said to them, 'Do everything that I ordered you to do to him.'" Verse 2. In other verses of this account, the Jewish mistreatment of Jesus is intensified. The Jewish authorities crucify Jesus and take him off the cross. The author is quite clear that they are the ones who are at fault. "They brought all things to fulfillment and completed all their sins on their heads." Verse 17. More significant still, the Jewish people realize that what they have done is wrong and that they will be punished for it. Then the Jews, the elders, and the priests realized how much evil they had done to themselves and began beating their breasts, saying, "Woe to us because of our sins! The judgment and the end of Jerusalem are near." Verse 25. This is a reference to the view found among Christians in the 2nd century and later that when the Roman armies destroyed Jerusalem in 70 CE, after a Jewish uprising, it was not for political or military reasons, but religious ones. Jerusalem was destroyed and the Jewish temple burned to the ground as divine retribution against the Jews for their sinful act of killing God's Messiah. Here in the Gospel of Peter, the Jewish people themselves recognize their guilt and their imminent punishment. In addition to the anti-Jewish character of this account, there are a number of other interesting legendary features. In the Gospels of the New Testament, Jesus is crucified with 2 others, as happens here. But in this Gospel, there is a curious incident. When those who crucified Jesus gamble for his clothes, one of the evildoers being crucified with him maligns them. "We have suffered like this for the evil things we did, but this one, the Savior of the people, what wrong has he done you?" The soldiers get angry at the man and order his legs not be broken so that he would die in torment. Verses 14 through 15. The idea is that a crucified man would die more quickly if he could not push up with his legs to relieve the pressure on his lungs and breathe. By not breaking the criminal's legs, they prolong his torment. One of the big questions of this Gospel is whether Jesus himself experiences any torment. In verse 11, we are told that Jesus was silent, as if he had no pain. Is it possible that this is one of the verses that Serapion found potentially objectionable? That Jesus appeared not to have pain because, in fact, he did not have any pain? That his body was a phantasm? A later verse is equally puzzling. When Jesus is about to die, rather than crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? As, say, in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 15, verse 34. He instead cries, my power, O power, you have left me behind. And then we are told, when he said this, he was taken up. Doesn't this sound like the other kind of docetism? The kind where the divine Christ leaves the human Jesus to die alone? The most striking passage of the Gospel comes at the very end, a passage that provides us with something we never find in the New Testament Gospels, an actual account of the resurrection. As I pointed out in chapter 1, the canonical Gospels do not narrate the resurrection of Jesus. In their stories, Jesus is crucified, dies, and is buried, and on the third day the women go to the tomb and find it empty. But there is no story in the Gospels of the New Testament about Jesus coming out of the tomb alive. The Gospel of Peter, however, does have such a story. As happens in the Gospel of Matthew, but in none of the other canonical Gospels, a guard is posted at the tomb of Jesus to make sure that no one comes to steal the body. But unlike in Matthew, in the Gospel of Peter, a very peculiar sequence of events occurs while the guards are looking on. The heavens open up, and two men descend, while the stone in front of the tomb rolls aside. The two heavenly men enter the tomb. Terrified, the soldiers go off to wake the centurion to tell him what has happened. But while they are talking, they look up and see three figures emerge from the tomb. Two of them are so tall that their heads reach up to the sky. The one they are supporting, Jesus obviously, is taller still. His head reaches above the sky. And then behind them, the cross itself emerges from the tomb, and a voice comes from heaven asking, have you preached to those who are asleep? And the cross replies, yes. So, at the resurrection, we have a giant Jesus and a walking, talking cross. The narrative is meant, of course, to be highly symbolic. Divine beings are often portrayed as gigantic in ancient texts. Jesus is the tallest since he is the most divine, and the cross is said to have proclaimed its message, the news of the salvation brought to those who are asleep, that is, to those who are already dead and waiting for the salvation to come. The Gospel continues by indicating that the Jewish authorities go to Pilate and urge him to cover up the story by ordering the soldiers not to breathe a word of what they have seen. Then comes an account of the women going to the tomb to anoint the body of Jesus, only to learn that he has been raised. The disciples are still grieving over what has happened, not knowing yet about the resurrection. Then we have the concluding sentences of the Gospel. But we, the 12 disciples of the Lord, wept and grieved, and each one returned to his home, grieving for what had happened. But I, Simon Peter, and my brother Andrew, took our nets and went off to the sea. And with us was Levi, the son of Alphaeus, whom the Lord... Verses 59 through 60. And there it ends, right in the middle of a sentence. The reason the account seems to start in the middle of a thought, and definitely ends in the middle of a sentence, is that the person who created this book of 66 pages, probably in the 6th century, had only a fragmentary account in front of him. It is impossible to say whether the complete Gospel of Peter included stories of Jesus' birth, life, ministry, teachings, miracles, and so on, before the account of his passion and resurrection. What is clear, from the final verse, is that this Gospel, unlike the Gospels of the New Testament, is written in the first person. The author claims to be Peter. But there is no way he was Peter. This is an author claiming to be someone he is not. This is a forgery. The reason Simon Peter could not have written this account is that it almost certainly dates to the 2nd century, at least 60 years after Peter had died. Virtually all scholars agree on this for compelling reasons. For one thing, the heightened anti-Judaism fits better with the 2nd century, when it became common, for example, for Christians to blame the destruction of Jerusalem on the Jews themselves for killing Jesus. Moreover, there are the highly legendary aspects of the story, such as the robber whose legs were not broken, the giant Jesus and the talking cross. These two suggest it is a later account. Scholars debate whether the author of this Gospel had access to the stories of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There are numerous parallels with one or the other of the Gospels throughout. If he did use them, then he was obviously writing after them, that is, no sooner than the beginning of the 2nd century. Scholars also debate whether this is the Gospel of Peter that was known to Serapion. In part, the debate has been over whether this is really a docetic account, as the Gospel described by Serapion evidently was, at least in his eyes.